This is an MUT Radio podcast.
And to everyone else who has prepared themselves, people always do this. I don't know why when I'm on stage. I mean, they're sending a wrong message to the audience. You know, I deliberately avoided bringing it down to my level. Thank you. Thank you very much. I have decided to leave the talking to the rest of us here who will be participating in the conference. But a heartfelt welcome from me. You will have heard from Mr. Nyondo that this is the 11th installment of our conference. I'll say more about that, Adam, next time about the conference. Last year, we were celebrating our 10th year anniversary, and we were at Zimbali, and it was a great event indeed. And as you will see from the number of institutions that support the conference, that this has become an unmissable event on the teaching and learning calendar in higher education in South Africa. Just during COVID, Professor Habib participated in an online presentation together with Professor Maluleke. I don't remember who else was in that. Well, we had connectivity challenges at the time. We were in the same venue. But then we thought, let's bring you here, you know, live to South Africa. And thank you very much for agreeing to come to the conference, and welcome to your home country, South Africa. Let's give Prof. Habib a round of applause. And thanks to Professor Bauer. I don't remember how many times Prof. Bauer has been to this conference. He has seen it all. He has been here. I'm sure this could be the third or the fourth time he's been headlining our conference. We welcome you, Prof. Bauer. My team has been like saying to me, don't you have his number? We're trying to write him. He's not responding. I said, okay, let's wait until the last minute. But true to your integrity, you showed up even when they were trying to unleash a plan B in case they don't see you. But as we were talking, they wrote back to me and said, he is here. I said, okay, welcome, Prof. Bauer. Let's give him a round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to the MUT executive that I've seen here. Professor Sbia, welcome. I'm welcoming you as the new VC for MUT. I haven't met you since you were the VC officially. So it's good to meet you. I see you look fresher since the appointment. So congratulations. As Mchaileni Zandla, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to Dr. Nchanga, says
You're listening to MUT Radio.
You're listening to
Call the studio now on 031-907-7194.
I welcome you all.
Listening to the Vugu
here as well. She's been facilitating our workshop since Monday. And yeah, they do a good job. It's the second time you are back by popular demand. And that is why we had to bring you back, because the colleagues felt last year the time was shorter. Prof. Ntswe, I'm told, is here. I haven't seen him. He's been doing the writing for publications workshop. And Prof. Archer, I haven't seen her. Oh, there, the hand goes up. You don't want to miss her presentation. I'm going to miss it for some reason. But it wasn't last year. It was this year at the Teaching with Technology Summit. The audience just said, no, bring her back. You'll see how you bring her back in whatever role, but we want her back. So we thank you that you also agreed to hear Dr. Oliver Seal in absentia. I welcome you. And I welcome all of you, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues from MUT and colleagues from all other institutions. If I've missed you, you will be acknowledged during the course of the day. I'm going to step off the stage and give Professor Spear the space to come and say something to us and officially say you can take off your jackets and relax. And then thereafter, it will be Professor Bauer who will take over the stage. Prof. Spear, welcome to MUT Focus Conference 2024. Let's welcome Prof. Spear. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At least I'm not alone.
Yes. I'm not alone. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Makua, for the kind introduction. Esteemed guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. On behalf of the Mangosuthu University of Technology, I extend my warm welcome to you and thank you for attending the MUT 2024 11th Focus Conference. I also wish to recognize and welcome our partners and friends who will be participating actively during the presentations. Dr. Makua has done the honors of mentioning them by name, so I'm not going to waste time. They will be properly introduced just before their presentations. I also welcome delegates from sister universities. We are excited as MUT to host you in our beautiful city of Durban as we deliberate on how we can make a difference in improving the higher education sector. Ladies and gentlemen, the theme for this year's conference is 3 decades of democracy, reflecting on higher education achievements, challenges, impact, and the future. This year, our country marks 3 decades of democracy and freedom. And by the way, MUT is also celebrating 45 years anniversary. And as MUT, as we celebrate our 45 years of existence, let us ponder about ways in which this university that was founded by the late Honorable Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi in 1979, with only 15 students, 15 male students, by the way, and now with a base of more than 40,000 alumni and 14,500 students, can become a change maker in enhancing the core business of the university, which is teaching and learning. The Focus Conference started as a colloquium in 2013 and later transformed to be a fully fledged conference. By the way, this is a brainchild of Dr. Makua and TLDC. Wherever you are, please, if ever you could stand up. And ladies and gentlemen, let's give them a round of applause. Dr. Makua and TLDC. Thank you. Thank you so much. The Focus Conference focuses on higher education issues and scholarship of teaching and learning. The conference offers a wide range of sessions, workshops, and roundtable discussions on a variety of topics related to teaching and learning in higher education. Over 150 delegates attend the conference annually, and the profile of this conference, it includes academic leaders, lecturers, researchers, higher education practitioners, as well as postgraduate students. It provides a platform where delegates and presenters share their experiences, research, knowledge, and best practices in teaching and learning, and explore innovative approaches to education. During the past 2 days, we have attended pre-conference workshops that were facilitated by experts that provided delegates with critical skills and practical knowledge on various topics. And ladies and gentlemen, the proceedings of the 2022 and 2023 Focus Conference were published in Atlantis Press, which is part of Springer Nature. Atlantis Press in Index, which is Index, among others, DOAJ, Web of Science, and Scopus. And I hope Dr. Makua, again, the 2024 conference will also be featured in the Springer Nature. So ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy the 11th Focus Conference. But before I step away from the podium, I have been asked to introduce the first plenary speaker. He is a theoretical physicist and a professor at the Johannesburg Business School, University of Johannesburg, where he works on complexity theory and organizations. He is also an affiliated professor at Tokyo College at the University of Tokyo and a fellow of Zolbeck Center of Migration on Mobility and Mobility at the New School for Social Research. Previously, until September 2022, he served as the Chief Executive Officer of Universities South Africa, known as USAF. Prior to that, from 2016, he held the esteemed position of being the Vice Chancellor and Principal at the Durban University of Technology. By the way, he was my boss. Back then, I was the head of department. Maybe I need to mention that it was quite an honor and humbling for us to have to host him in our department of nursing, where I was the HOD. It's very rare to find a vice chancellor visiting the academic departments. So it was an honor for us to host him in our department. He has also served as the deputy vice chancellor and principal at Durban Westville of University of Natal, later known as the University of KwaZulu-Natal. He has extensive academic career, which includes a faculty position in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Hunter College City, University of New York. He was also a member of a doctoral faculty at the Graduate Center and held the role of Associate Provost for Curriculum Development. He serves on several advisory boards, such as the South African Institute of Distance Education, the Center for AIDS Program on Research of South Africa, and the Higher Education Support Program of the Open Society Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Ahmed Bawa.
Good morning, everybody. I see Nora. Hi. It's very nice to see all of you, and thank you so much for having me here again. And it's always a pleasure to come to the MUT conferences. I said to Adam yesterday or the day before yesterday, it's easy to say no to the University of Cape Town, but it's very hard to say no to MUT. So it's always a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much. And I also, I'm also so pleased to see that there's such a good turnout because, I think people, there's a lot of fatigue now of conferences and so on. So it really is a testament to what you've been able to put together, I think. And I think that the other thing just to mention is what Professor Sibiya said earlier, and that is just to say, welcome to Durban. Like, I took a walk last night, I took a walk again this morning, and it really is exceptional, I mean, as a city, I think. Let's hope that we can pull it together and get the beaches clean and so on. So, I want to just begin by saying that it is indeed a very good time for us to reflect on the last 30 years. I often describe South Africa's democracy as one that's sort of growing up, you know, but 30 years is a long time. And now it really is time for us to begin to move on, you know, and to begin to like think quite hard about what the next 30 years is going to be like, and to put in place those kinds of things that we've learned about in the last 30 years that would make an impact. There's a lot of these reviews going on at the moment. I mean, right now I'm chairing a review of the NQF. And again, you know, so it's really an opportunity for us to really step back and think quite hard about what we need to do to make a success in the next 30 years. And of course, higher education is central to the project. And so it really is worthwhile, I think, for us to think quite hard about what we've learned in the last 30 years and what to proceed with in the future. Of course, you know, universities, and I'll come back to this a little later on, you know, universities are not isolated, right? I mean, we can't say that South African universities are completely sort of immune, like, to what's going on in the rest of the world. Eh? On the one hand, we have an internal environment which is changing very rapidly. On the other hand, universities are knowledge-intensive institutions, so they're global in nature just by that fact that they are knowledge intensive, because knowledge doesn't kind of perceive any boundaries and borders and so on. And so we also have to be aware of what's going on globally. And I'm very pleased that you've invited Professor Habib here as well, because it gives us an opportunity really to understand what's going on in other parts of the world. And of course, there's this massive change in geopolitics that is taking place globally. And a part of that is the shift in the center of gravity, if you like, of higher education. Now, a few years ago, if you asked me, where is the center of gravity of research and knowledge production and so on, it would have been easy. You know, we would have just said it's in the middle of the North Atlantic, if you like. Well, it's not there anymore. You know, it's now very much shifted to the east. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, that there isn't fantastic stuff going on in the global north, and particularly in the west. But at the same time, I think we all have to sort of come to grips with the idea that we are in this multipolar context now, with lots of different areas with sort of rising higher education enterprises. Okay, so, I've chosen the topic quite deliberately, because what I've perceived over the last period of time is, like, you know, over the last year or so, is that people are saying, yeah, what have we learned about the last 30 years in higher education? And I'm saying, well, actually, you know, that's the wrong question. The question really is, you know, what's the journey of higher education through 30 years of democracy, right? I mean, I think that we have to step back and ask ourselves, what have we done in the last 30 years? You know, how have we contributed to democracy? How have we contributed to the economy and so on? And that's a slightly different question, because you see, one of the things that we always face is this danger of becoming self-referential, right? That we always start looking inside the system, if you like it. I'm going to sort of come back to this, but you know, universities are really hugely integrated into the political economies they find themselves in. And so therefore, it's really important to get a sense of what that context looks like. Okay. So let's get my glasses on. I'm getting older. Okay. Okay. So I just start off with a few quotes, you know, just to give you a sense of, there's a sense in which, like, there's a kind of growing unhappiness, if you like, of higher education around the world. So this is Stephen Mintz at the University of Texas. And what he says is that the mistrust pervades higher education. Large segments of the public are convinced that higher education is a self-serving scam. Okay, so this is really radical stuff, right? On the edge. Right? And by the way, there were lots of responses to this. But this is a very senior kind of academic, right, speaking. You know, The public is concerned about the fact that the cost is too high. We can relate to all of these things. It's quality and payoff too low, and it's faculty too uninterested in the first job they should be doing, which is teaching. So, interestingly, you know, this is not just coming out of thin air. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you look at the undergraduate kind of enrollments in the U.S., over the last 12, 13 years, there's been a continuous decline. Right? So there's a set of concerns that we have to address, if you like, in terms of the public perception. I then switch to India. Like, just, there's a fascinating quote for me. Like, you know, India had this, and I come back to this a little later on. India had this great imagination about the role of science, you know, kind of really leading the way into the future. And this is Atma Ram, who's the chair of India's National Committee on Science and Technology, which was created by Nehru, the first prime minister. And I'll come back to Nehru because, you know, I want to make a point about what he said. And this is Atma Ram, who says, why is it that science in independent India, despite all the investments in it, is not the potentially creative force it threatened to be during the nationalist period? I mean, in some senses, that's exactly the question that we have to ask. Because, you know, when we were working on all the policy documents in 1990, even going through to 95, 96, 97, and many of us were involved in those, we had this amazing euphoria about the role of science, you know, the science sort of shaping the future and so on. So this is a very powerful statement from the highest body. The NCST in India was equivalent of NACI, the National Advisory Council on Innovation here. And it was meant to advise the Prime Minister on the role of science. And so he's asking, well, you know, we made all these investments. What has happened? I speak about science here because in South Africa, at least, the universities are by far the biggest performers of science. Okay? So, you know, it's really about also a question of the universities. Then there's this fascinating book called The University in Ruins. I think I've probably spoken about this to you before, written by Bill Reddings. By the way, he died before the book was published. And in this book, sort of, he explores the impact of globalization on higher education and for the American universities and how it has dislocated the universities from the original purpose, if you like. And it's a fascinating read. And if you haven't, you know, if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, I would really suggest it very much. It's quite a detailed book, and he critiques the way in which universities have become dislocated from the context in which they are kind of located, if you like. This is Kenneth Rogoff. I'm not going to read this, but Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard, and he basically said, you know what, universities have been so essential in causing disruptions in other parts, in other sectors, industry sectors. You know, all you have to do is think about, you know, the health sector or the transport sector. You think about it, it's all there. He says, why is it that universities haven't begun this process of disruption of themselves? Universities are meant to be central to the project of the economy and so on. Why is it that they haven't disrupted themselves? Why is it that they are sticking to a kind of business model which is so traditional? And then the final one I just want to mention is by a group of colleagues of mine. I work with them at University of Pennsylvania. And they say, you know, one, there's a little just two-liner in this book, like, which is also a very nice, interesting book. And they say, if American universities were so great, why were American cities so pathological? You know, they're all located within these urban contexts. You know, you take every one of those great universities, and right around those universities is desolation. So the question is, you know, they pose this question. Interesting, right? Okay. So the purpose of these is just to say that there's a lot of concern in the world about the nature of higher education. Okay. So we have to just remind ourselves that higher education is a major enterprise in South Africa, right? Although we've got just 26 universities. They really punch above their weight. We produce more than 200,000 graduates a year. By the way, think about that. What it means essentially is that the economy has to produce 200,000 new jobs every year for graduates. Otherwise, you know, the unemployment rate of graduates goes up. Of course, there's some attrition through death and retirements and so on. But essentially what we have to do is produce 200,000 jobs per annum. The unemployment rate of graduates is about 10%. It used to be 6%, by the way, in 2015, 2016, it was about 6%. It's now, according to Stats SA, it's now 10%. And we haven't really had a major study done on the unemployment rate, and that's something that we should be doing. It's the 100 billion rand economic sector, if you like. I mean, that's the way to think about it. You know, that's how much money comes into the universities, and that's how much they spend. It's 100 billion rand, something like that. Yeah, we did a little calculation, and it's published, by the way, in the South African Journal of Science, about the contribution of higher education to the economy, to the fiscus. And that exceeds 500 billion rand a year. So it's a major contributor to, you know, to the national economy. And we have to just keep that in mind. We looked at just four things. We just looked at the production of graduates and the extra tax that graduates pay to SARS. So in other words, it's not looking at the total tax they pay, but the extra tax beyond the matric qualification. Right? So we say matriculants earn a certain average salary. Graduates earn a little bit extra. How much extra do they pay to SARS on top of the matrix kind of tax base, if you like? So that's the one thing. The second thing we looked at was the impact of research. The third was international students, although it's very small in South Africa, just 7%. And then fourthly, we looked at universities as business entities kind of buying and selling stuff, right? So if you look at those four components, the contribution is about 500 billion rand. If you look at the gross value add of higher education to the economy, it's about the fourth or fifth largest sector in the country. So in other words, it's like really at the same level of gold as gold mining. I know that sounds a bit weird, but it's true, okay? Those figures don't come from us, they come from Stats SA. And just about the same level as gold, way bigger than sort of a whole range of other sectors that you can compare them to. Of course, we all know that it produces social mobility, and we have to say that, you know, it contributes to deepening democracy and social coherence and so on. And I think we have to ask questions how well we've done with those two last two. We have to ask ourselves whether, you know, what is the impact of social mobility? What is the kind of contribution to deepening democracy and so on? Okay. Oh, sorry, I should have just looked at the... So if you look at the system now, we have 1.3 million students. In 1994, there were about 490,000 students. Okay, so we've almost tripled the number of students in higher education. The women-to-men ratio is 0.61 to 0.39. And that's also a very significant increase on 1994, when it was about 50-50. We have to start asking the question, what's happening to the boys? I think that's a very serious question to ask. Where are they? What are they doing? Are they studying? Are they not studying? Are they employed, unemployed? You know, what's going on with them? The race representation approaches the national demographic. About 80% of students now are Black African students. So that's excellent progress of what it was in 1994, when it was about 20%. But, okay, and the participation rate is at about 22% of 18 to 24-year-olds. But when you do the breakdown of the participation rate, that's where you see the legacy of apartheid beginning to play itself out. So what one sees then, when you look at that, is that the participation rate of white and Indian South Africans is in the region of between 40 and 50%, 18 to 24-year-olds. If you look at colored and African kids, it's in the region of about 20%. Okay, so very big gap there. So we've made some progress, but we haven't made a lot of progress. So it means that we have to really think quite hard about how to address that. And the throughput rate, I have to say, is gradually improving. I mean, if you take contact students now, And if you look at the throughput rate of contact students over the, you know, over a period of time, so in other words, not immediately after qualification, but say period of qualification plus 2 or 3 years, then that participation rate of contact students, these just by emphasis there, is about 75%. So that's very good. It's an indication that there's still some level of there's still some way for us to go, but we've made significant progress. The research output in 2022 was 25,000 units. It's flattened out since then. In fact, I've heard that actually there's an indication that it's going to decline. Largely, I think that's due to the fact that the amount of money that's being spent by the government on DSI has been in decline. That's part of the story. But we just have to keep in mind that in 2005, that figure was like 7,000. So we've had a very rapid increase in the kind of research output. However, I think we have to ask questions about what's going on there. You know, just what is the quality of the research output? Is the research output of value to the society we are in? Who's shaping the knowledge projects? Who's funding the research? The range of questions that need to be asked about that. Yeah, I wanted to show you this. I mean, you won't be able to read it, but this shows you that higher education is right next to gold, okay? By the way, I think that this is from 2018. Actually, I have to tell you that it's now, there's that higher education would have moved much more to the left now, because there's been a very significant increase in the amount of money that has been, that flows through the system. Okay, we always, you know, have to go back to Fees Must Fall, right? Because actually Fees Must Fall, Roads Must Fall, because actually in a sense, that was like a, what do you call it? Like a moment of, a moment for introspection, a moment for reflection and so on. And I think we can, you know, at some point we'll have to get over that period, but there's still a lot to be learned, I think, for us. The first, you know, if you ask me, what's the takeaway? It's, for me, it's really simple. I mean, I look at higher education, what happened in higher education 2015, 2017. And for me, it's really about saying we have to reassert this idea of higher education as a public good. You know, and what that means in essence is that we have to make it possible for the state has to make it possible for higher education to be as accessible as possible to as many people as possible. And, you know, I'll come back to this a little later on. And I think the question we are, you know, the question that occurred to me at least at that point, and I think many other people have asked the same question, and that is, you know, did we arrive in 2015, 2017? Did we arrive after a long journey? Did we arrive at some kind of breakdown of social compact? And I'm talking about social compact of the transition 1994 and the National Commission on Higher Education 1995 and the Higher Education White Paper and so on, and the Higher Education Act and so on, which came out of that NCHE process. And I would say, in fact, that we did arrive at a kind of breakdown of the social compact that was captured in the National Commission on Higher Education. You know, there's a whole range of things that we succeeded very much at doing in the in that period, 1994, 1995, we kind of achieved the National Commission on Higher Education. It had a whole range of demands of the universities, addressed the race gap, addressed the gender gap, addressed the fragmentation in our system, addressed the disarticulation of the system with the society, and so on. There's a range of the efficiency and effectiveness. Those are the five things that occur to me now, but there were other things. We've done well in all of those things, actually. We have made progress. I shouldn't say we did done well. We've made progress on all of those issues. The question is, what happened in the intervening period? Fees Must Fall, of course, was a kind of the spark for a much broader set of reflections about higher education. And it is about the role of higher education in producing a better society. That is my kind of take on it. And we have to spend time with this. I've listed a set of meetings here, and you know, that we had to engage in at the time. And I'm not going to go through the details there. But just to say, you know, that one of the things that happened during that time, there was a day in October 16, 2016, when 18 of the universities were shut and others were on the verge of shutting down. And I had call after call after call from Greb Sponde, who was the TG at DHET, who was saying, yeah, should we shut down the system? The minister thinks we should shut down the system. Let's give ourselves some time and so on. And, you know, the response we had was that we shouldn't do that, you know, because if you did that, then how would you reopen if you don't have anything on the table? You know? And the advice we got from people in Nigeria and Kenya and so on is don't shut down. Because if you shut down, you find it very hard to restart again. But I'm going to come back to that in a short while. Yeah, the thing that occurred to me at least is that the universities were defenseless at that time, right? Universities were like basically to fend for themselves. I mean, you all had that experience. And it raises a set of questions. You know, the first question that occurs to me is, who owns our universities? You know, is it the vice-chancellor? Is it the council of the universities? No, these are social institutions, right? So then the next question is, why is the social ownership of our universities so low? You know, why didn't people come out in support of the universities to say, no, there may be something's wrong with our university, but we need to protect these institutions. By the way, some universities did have that. When I look at WITS, UCT, and so on, they did have that. But for the majority of universities, there was nothing. By the way, not even the government actually came out in support of the universities. So, you know, there's a set of questions we have to ask ourselves. And one of them is, why is the social ownership of our universities so low? And I'm not suggesting that this is just a South Africa problem. It's a problem in other parts of the world as well. So, you know, I've got this slide which I use very often. You know, universities are social institutions. They are created, they are established, and they're sustained by society. And there's a reason for that, and that's because they're regarded as central to the effective functioning of sort of multi-layered societies, right? Complex economies, complex politics, complex kind of social kind of structures, and so on. So they are increasingly kind of important in those multi-layered societies. They are knowledge-intensive institutions. They are special in that regard, right? I mean, that's what drives our universities, the fact that they are knowledge-intensive. They create new knowledge, they disseminate knowledge, they apply knowledge. They are knowledge-intensive institutions. That's what they do. But they are special. You see, there are other kinds of knowledge-intensive institutions. You know, I worked at the CERN in Geneva, the Center for Nuclear Research there, and there are 7,000 physicists there. But actually, it's not a university because there are no students there. It doesn't have students. It's only universities as social institutions that have students. So they are special in that regard. And I'm saying this because we have to think quite hard about, when we think about the purpose of universities, we have to think about that role, that specific role. And one of the things that we have to come to grips with is that if we don't pay attention, universities can potentially be complicit in the reproduction of inequality. So we have to pay attention to that. We have to think about how we design a system which counteracts that kind of normal force, if you like. You know, that's what universities do, right? Universities kind of really, they're on kind of autopilot, right? You know, they get money from the state, they kind of get fees paid in. There's good value for the young people. You take the eye off the ball, and then you realize that actually 10 years down the line, universities are critiqued for being very kind of insular, kind of really, you know, not responding to the challenges of society and so on. So again, I just want to emphasize this idea of focusing on the public good role of higher education. So we know what universities can offer, and I'm not going to go through all of this, but we know that I hope you can read that, that they produce graduates, right? They produce experts, professionals, scientists, artists. We should also include the intellectuals, right? You know, that's part of the function of universities, produce intellectuals. They strengthen the knowledge base of a society through graduates and research. They build democracy. We have to ask how they do all of these things, and we can have a discussion about that. They produce knowledge, information, and data to address the grand challenges we face as societies. Not just local society, but also global society. They contribute to innovation and industrial innovation and disruption, as we mentioned earlier, and so on. So I'm not going to go through all of these, but just to say that we know that these are the things that universities can offer. The big challenge is to understand how to kind of really ensure that it offers these things by being responsive and relevant on the one hand, but ensuring that they maintain the highest levels of quality and excellence on the other. So there's a dialectic between these two. You know, if we just slip into this mode of delivery, if you like, you know, that we just kind of really, you know, just respond to every problem in a fashion that is really not knowledge based, then we end up with a situation where we can erode the quality of what we do and erode excellence of our graduates and our research and so on. So we have to understand the tension between these two. And I'm not going to go through this either, but it's just this fact that universities are not, you know, independent. There are these grand challenges that we face, and the grand challenges are both local and global. And that's what makes universities so powerful as institutions, because universities themselves are local and global in nature. They have a physical location, but they also operate in this global terrain, and that makes them very powerful. And one of the things that we have to think about is this role of universities as interlocutors between the global, national, and local. You know, the impact of all these big decisions that are taken at the United Nations on climate change or food security or whatever, that those decisions ultimately have an impact at the local level, right? At the level of the local small farmer, or the local community and so on. And universities can play this very powerful role of being the interlocutor between these different levels, if you like. And that's, of course, not a trivial challenge, but something that we have to work at, it seems to me. As I mentioned earlier, we are in this era where we are seeing this rise of populism, seeing this distrust in science and experts, and we are seeing this slide into anti-intellectualism. You might ask, well, what has that got to do with universities? Well, it's right at the heart of the university, because actually that's our job, is to produce experts, to produce knowledge. And if society doesn't, if there's a decrease in trust in the production of experts in science and so on, then we are in trouble, because then it means that universities, as these very powerful social institutions, begin to kind of face the possibility of erosion. We all talk about the new digital moment, and I'm at UJ, and you know, it's the buzz, right? The new digital moment that we are in. But we can't ignore it, because it's so influential in what we do now, not just in terms of teaching and learning. By the way, I would argue that the impact of the new digital technologies on research way exceeds like the impact on teaching and learning. If there's time at the end and you'd like to hear some examples, I'll be happy to share with you. But something that used to take 6 months to do now takes 10 or 15 seconds to do in areas. And the whole nature of knowledge production is changing. The scientific method is being tested on a regular basis. And there really has been a new kind of the emergence of new forms of science. So I mentioned earlier the kind of the challenge of social ownership of universities. There's a fracturing geopolitics taking place. So we've seen that now. We all know, you know, that, you know, just how universities have been impacted around the world. And we see these mass migrations around the world. And, you know, as Professor Sibiya sort of read out, I'm a part of something called the Zolberg Center on Migration, which has a program for academic scholars like from around the world who are in exile. Yeah, so universities can't turn away from these, right? They have to deal with them because it's a part of their environment. Yeah, you know, in physics, there are four fundamental forces, right? It's gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. By the way, the last three we've kind of unified now into a single force. So we can explain everything in the universe in terms of those four forces, and at least we think we can explain. And then there's some fundamental particles. Well, when I think about higher education, I think there are three things. The first one is politicization. We are constantly under pressure, right, to kind of do this, do that. We are kind of having to contend with different kind of audiences. We are constantly under pressure to kind of, you know, to side with governmental, geopolitical positions. And I'm sure you've all seen that around the world recently. The second is this process of democratization. I don't mean democratization of the academic processes and so on, that too, but largely this idea that universities used to be highly elite, and now, for elite audiences, now the idea is very much that it should be massified, that we should really move, broaden the base of higher education. And we'll come back to that just now. And then there's the issue of decolonization. And decolonization, I just want to emphasize, is not a project of the Global South. It's a global project. I mean, the knowledge production in the global north is really shaped on kind of a colonial sort of mentality, if you like. So it's not surprising then that you're seeing these movements around the world around decolonization. And none of these can be escaped. We have to kind of deal with them. We have to kind of work with them. And Professor Sibiya, this is something that you're going to have to deal with, I think, as you work through your career. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to something which might be a bit controversial, and I want to just kind of put it out there. So, you see, if we look at the RDP, and then the NCHE, and now in 2024, I've just kind of listed a few things, right? In the RDP, there were expectations that universities would contribute to nation building, that they would address apartheid's legacies, and that they would deepen democracy, that they would contribute to the building of a knowledge economy. Now, you know how realistic that was, another matter. That we would move towards a flexible labor market instead of a rigid labor market, that workers wouldn't be like trapped in jobs, that they would have the opportunity to expand beyond their jobs, their current jobs, and that we would move towards a more inclusive economy. So the knowledge economy wouldn't be the kind of knowledge economy you would have in other parts of the world, that it would be built on the basis of inclusivity and so on. That we would have a single integrated framework for education and training. That's something my head is sort of buzzing with at the moment because of this NQF review that I'm involved in. That there would be multiple learning pathways, and there would be learning opportunities for all, and the idea of social justice, right, would be kind of central to that. Now, you see, if you look at those, what you see, in fact, is that it's very demand-led. It's like a society saying, what are we expecting from our higher education system? See, if you go to the NCHE now, we see it has nation building, that it must deepen democracy, it must deal with the race and gender inequalities that are in the system, that it must address fragmentation, that it must address massification, it must produce research, contribute to innovation, that it must produce graduates for the labor market, and then of course GEAR came on the scene, and you know how we're going to respond to GEAR. The NQF then developed three sub-frameworks. Well, I mean, this didn't happen at the time of the NCHE. This happened later. Three quality councils. See, when I look at these, the emphasis shifted for me. Now the emphasis is, what can the university supply? They can supply graduates. They can supply research. They can contribute to they must address the fragmentation. They must address the race and gender imbalances that are in the system. So it, for me at least, there's a fundamental shift between the RDP and the NCHE. And I want to argue, in fact, that that set a trend, if you like. So if we go to 2024 now, we see that there's significant instability, and I'm not going to go through all of this because you all know all of these things. But what we are seeing now is this idea that universities are sort of unanchored, that they are now it's about branding. You know, it's about making sure that we have a decent ranking, you know, so that students choose to go to that university. So ranking is not about what the universities do. It's about what do the universities do that make it possible to attract students. Okay? Now, clearly, this is more important for some universities than for other universities. Okay? But what I'm suggesting is that if we go from the RDP to the NCHE to where we are now, what we are seeing is this kind of slide, if you like. You know, well, I shouldn't say slide. The slide means that you're going downwards, right? But this kind of shift, if you like, you know, from what was a demand-led kind of enterprise in the RDP to a supply-side focus in the NCHE. And then, now I know this is a bit pushing it a bit, but I just want to make an argument, right? And I'll give some detail just now. Okay, so how much longer do I have? 5 minutes, okay. Right, so I'm going to skip this slide. Okay, and I must skip that one too. Okay, so now let's just have a look at this, right? So first of all, we see that the unemployment rate of graduates appears to be increasing. We don't know for sure yet. But if you look at the Stats SA, that's what you see. What we do know for sure is that in 2015, 2016, unemployment rate of graduates is about 6.2%. All the indications from Stats SA is that that figure is now in the region of about 10%, 10 or 11%. By the way, you have to be really careful with the Stats SA figures on employment because they are a snapshot taken at a particular point in time. Depends when that snapshot is taken, right? If it's very close to the graduation period, then that figure is very high. And when it's, you have to be careful with those numbers. Now, here's an important thing. See, GRD and BRD, I'll just explain what they are. GRD is the gross expenditure on R&D. Gross expenditure on R&D as a fraction of GDP. BRD is the business.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.